Hello, I'm Timothy Patrick McCarthy. Welcome to this episode of Justice Matters, where I will be in conversation with Leo Varadkar about a range of issues related to contemporary human rights and global democracy. Dr. Leo Varadkar is the 14th Taoiseach of Ireland. It's the Prime Minister of Ireland. He's also a Hauser leader here at the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and a senior fellow with the Global LGBTQI Plus Human Rights Program at the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights. Leo, great to be with you. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great. So this is a Justice Matters podcast at the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights at the Harvard Kennedy School. And you are living the same world that I'm living in. And I was wondering if we could just start by you talking a bit about what you think the most pressing human rights or justice or political challenges are in the world that we're living in today.
Yeah, well, I think the most worrying thing is the basic and global pushback against freedom of speech and freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. To the extent that we have a huge number of people who claim to be free speech advocates and freedom of expression advocates, but are really only in favor of it when it's their type. And that's evident from both sides of the political spectrum, but something that really worries me. And I'm a kid who grew up during the Cold War.
I remember
the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Right.
And in the decades after that, there was a general presumption that the world was on a glide path towards democracy, even liberal democracy, respect for human rights around the world, respect for individuals, freedoms and identities. And I'm not sure when that stopped or when that started going backwards, but it definitely really is. And that just reminds me of the fact that progress is not inevitable and can be reversed. And it makes it all the more important now, I think, to be a human rights advocate and to do the kind of things that we do when it's less on trend, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's interesting because I've been reading your book, and obviously you go into your childhood, and it opens with you as a kid in the polling station with your mother, and you were 9, I believe, and you mentioned Reagan and Dukakis and 88, and I was thinking as I was reading it, I was kind of like, oh my God, we were same vintage, you and I. And I also grew up in the Cold War. And the wall in Berlin came down the first year of college for me. And the tanks in Tiananmen Square,
the
free speech movement, was the month I graduated from high school.
And the idea that Russia would be a democracy was seen probable at the time.
Yeah.
That they actually had free elections for a period.
Yeah, that's right.
And that maybe China might follow. And we're now so far back from that with places like India, Turkey, even America, Hungary backsliding on democracy. It's not something I actually thought would happen, but it is.
Yeah, I say all the time to my students that progress is neither inevitable nor irreversible, what you just said, and I think that's important. We are getting a strong reminder of that truth now. I wanted to go back to your childhood. As a kid, you were a precocious kid. You loved politics. You say in your book that you know, when you were 9, you were thinking maybe I could be a politician. So talk to me a little bit about the little Leo, the precocious little boy who goes to the polling station with his mother and listens to adult themes on the radio and television.
Yeah, well, adult political themes. Yes. And current affairs and so on.
But PG-13, not R-rated. Yes, of course.
Good. Yeah, but so look, I was a pretty unusual kid. Pretty normal upbringing in a middle-class household in suburban Dublin, but wasn't interested in sports in the way other boys weren't interested in the same things they were, but was very interested in news and politics and current affairs. And my memoir starts with me going to vote with my mom in what would have been the 1987 parliamentary elections in Ireland, and just being transfixed by elections, votes being counted, the electoral process, the idea that an ordinary person can run for election and then become somebody who has power and can do things for other people. And that seemed almost kind of magical at the time.
Was it the power piece or the people piece or that drew you to it? What was it about politics that you thought and voting that you were so drawn to?
I think it was two things, but I definitely liked the mathematics of it all. You know, liked elections, liked the counts, liked the numbers, and I have a mathematical mind, a scientific mind. So I definitely liked all of that. And then watching party rallies and conferences and so on, and getting an interest actually in policy issues probably came a bit later, more into my kind of college years, but probably started off with the with the process and the drama and the mathematics of politics, and the policy stuff came later.
Yeah. But you didn't come from a political family. You're not a political...
Not exactly, no.
Legacy politician or anything like that.
No, so neither of my parents were involved in politics or any political party. But I didn't know as much as maybe I should have about my Indian heritage, because my mum's from Ireland.
Right.
I grew up in Ireland, but she married a doctor, a man from India, mm-hmm. when they lived in England, and they came to live in Ireland, or back to Ireland afterwards. And my father's family had been involved in the independence struggle in India. So he had two brothers that were imprisoned by the British for peaceful opposition to British rule. And then I had an aunt who was one of the people who marched into Goa to take it back from the Portuguese.
Oh, wow.
But I was vaguely aware of these stories, but maybe I wasn't listening. Maybe my dad didn't tell me the stories in the right way. I don't know. But it was really only when I got to visit the town where he came from originally and sat in the council chamber where my uncle had been the mayor, saw these places, that I actually realized that, you know, I do have political blood in my veins, but not so much on the Irish side, more on the Indian side.
Oh, that's fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit, because many of our listeners will not understand the details and the nuances of Irish politics. So you were a party leader. You were the Taoiseach twice in two different terms, right? You've had many roles and worn many hats within your political system. And whenever you talk about politics in Ireland, I'm always interested about the dynamics between the parties and the coalitions that need to be built, and the precarity that sometimes comes with that. But it's very different, say, from the United States two-party system. And so if you could just talk a little bit about, like, make that make sense for those who aren't as familiar with it as you are.
So I suppose two fundamental differences with the American system: we have a parliamentary system rather than a presidential one. So power lies with the Taoiseach, the prime minister, rather than the president. That's largely a ceremonial role. So we inherited the British system, if you like, in that sense. And because we have proportional representation, because we don't have a winner-takes-all voting system. You vote preferentially 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That leads to a multi-party system. And that meant for a long time that it was possible to have single-party governments or majorities, but that has now become increasingly rare because politics has become, really around most of the world, has become more fragmented and more volatile. So parties that were dominant and almost people voted for that party because their parents did or their grandparents did, that is all broken down. So we have a very multi-party system now. And the two big parties that were on opposing sides in the Civil War when Ireland became independent are now actually in coalition together. So it'd be like maybe the Republicans and the Democrats coming together.
Which is unfathomable at the moment.
So but then, as you know, if you go back in your history, America had, you know, had Federalists and Republican Democrats and Whigs and different parties in the past.
I mean, our political party system has flipped at least twice in a major way. Really, actually, probably more than that. But we, you know, the shift. I mean, the first Republican president was Abraham Lincoln, right? And he was a very different kind of Republican than we have now. And then Franklin Roosevelt, as a Democrat, sort of won over a whole voting bloc that the Republicans have claimed for most of for a good chunk of the 19th century. So it's a fascinating thing to have the parties, the party formations, and the party dynamics change over time. But the coalitional nature of your politics is really important, and it had some bearing on your career and your rise as a party leader, and then ultimately as the head of state. So talk a little bit about those coalitions.
So essentially after the elections, the parties come together and try to form a coalition that will command a majority in the two houses of parliament. We have a Senate and a House of Representatives as well. And that means sharing out the cabinet posts. And it means agreeing a program for government at the start that is a blend of the two different parties' platforms, or the three different parties' platforms. So I served essentially in three governments, one being a two-party coalition, the second one which I led, which was a minority government, and that had its challenges, and then the third one, which was a three-party government, because we needed to bring in the Green Party to make up the numbers. And that actually had a big impact on policy. Upside is you have majorities. You know your government has a majority, so you can actually get things done. You're not down to individual. There's quite a strong whip system, so individual members have very little discretion on how they vote. They have to go with the party. So it means you can get things through, but it also means a lot of compromise, because there has to be trade-offs and there has to be compromises in order to form the coalition agreement. And coalitions can collapse. You'll see in some countries, Netherlands, Belgium, Italy, governs collapsing quite regularly. in Ireland, we've managed to kind of keep it going. And none of the governments that I was a member of ended early. They all completed their term.
Why is that? Why do you think Ireland's stable in that way?
It wasn't always, but it has been for the past 25 years. I think the main thing it's down to is trust and personal relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
So the agreements we had among the party leaders in government were always around good faith and no surprises. That we understood that if we all tried to compete with each other and get one over each other, that wasn't going to work.
Right.
After 6 months in government, the public see you as the government, they want you to work together and they expect you to. And I think as well in Ireland, and this wouldn't always be the case in countries, if a government is collapsed or brought down early, the people are more likely to want to blame the person who brought it down. They're less likely to buy this idea that I brought it down on some big issue rather than actually for a tactical reason.
Yeah, yeah. So you were a trailblazing Taoiseach. And you were, at the time, the youngest ever in the history of Ireland. You were also someone from a binational, multicultural background. You were also a doctor with an MD. And you were the first Trinity graduate, First Trinity graduate to be
TC. Not many people know that.
No, but now they do. The world now knows, exactly. And then, of course, the thing we have in common, you're gay. I'm also partly Irish as well. And you came out in office when you were in that role. And so I'm wondering if you could talk first. We'll get to the gay part in a second specifically, but I want to ask you, you're like a five-time first. And I do a lot of work in terms of thinking about leadership and communication. And one of the things that I'm increasingly fascinated by are the sort of opportunities and also burdens that firsts have when it comes to communicating and leading. And so, and really being free in a way, and we'll get to that later on too. But like, what was it like to be a multiple first?
Yeah, I think it was a very positive thing. Certainly at first it was anyway.
Yeah.
My party would be a sort of right-leaning party on economic issues, but maybe left-leaning on social issues. But the center of gravity, I think, in Irish politics will be to the left of where it is here in the US. And at the time, my party chose me to be their leader, and that's how I became Taoiseach Prime Minister. Right. It was seen really as a reflection of a country that was modernizing and was changing and was becoming very different and more liberal and more multicultural and more secular and all of those things. That was 2017. So in some ways I was fortunate. I kind of captured the zeitgeist at a time when people wanted to have a leader who reflected that the country was young and different and diverse.
And emerging and changing Ireland.
But that was that obviously... The ill wind of liberalism is also being felt in Ireland. So I wonder, would it actually be tougher now? I think probably not, but I wonder, would it be tougher now if I was trying to get that position 8 years later?
Was it easier or tougher or otherwise in the second term? You'd served twice as Taoiseach,
years apart. Well, by the second term, none of these things were a novelty.
Well, so, right, of course. you were just an old thing.
That guy who's been in government for more than 10 years already.
That tired one.
So the novelty was gone at that stage. But I think a challenge, though, that I experienced, because if you're head of government or head of state, you're there for all the people. You're not there for the different identities that you represent.
Right.
But I always wanted to help out people who were gay or LGBT, people who were from minority ethnic backgrounds. For lots of different reasons, you do want to kind of help out your own tribes, even though you're the chief of all the tribes, if that makes any sense.
Right.
But I had to kind of balance that because I didn't want people to think that I was overly concerned on minority issues rather than majority issues. And then there was the conflict as well with your own community. There would be a lot of people who in the LGBT community thought I didn't do enough, that I was too conservative. And again, even on issues of race and migration, there'd be people who would have taken that view as well. So leadership is a lonely place. You're surrounded by people on all sides.
Yeah.
And you've got big teams that you head up. But a lot of the time you're on your own, particularly when it comes to the very big decisions.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, all of those firsts are important. But how I came to know you or know of you was he was the gay one. Mm. And I remember being very proud of that as an Irish American who was also gay. And you know, we are of similar vintage in terms of our age. And so I followed you once that news broke, and it broke in a radio interview where you came out to millions of people. So that was a different coming out story than mine. It wasn't broadcast news. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I work with a fair number of out LGBT politicians here. Pete Buttigieg is a former student of mine, and we have some wonderful people who are real trailblazers in that regard. And you are. You are an openly gay head of state at a time of real change in the world. And so I'm wondering, how did you navigate that, right? You didn't have a wife and kids, right? You weren't, you obviously now have a partner of many years, but you had to navigate all that comes with a gay life and a gay identity. And you were single for a little bit of that time. Like, how did you navigate that? And how did you navigate that as a gay politician or the prime minister who happened to be gay?
Yeah, well, I was kind of fortunate that I did have a partner by the time I became party leader and prime minister.
That's right. That's right.
I think it would have been hard to be dating while you hold high office. Not that it hasn't been done though. We had a former prime minister whose marriage broke down, and he had girlfriends,
or like presidents on Grindr or something.
So it's not it's not that it can't be done. But
you need a communication strategy for that, I'm sure. Yeah.
But I was fortunate that I had a partner at that time.
Who's also a doctor.
Still is my partner, 10 years later, which is a long time in gay years.
But
like, there were, we weren't married and we're still not married. So there would have been kind of small issues around, do we issue invitations jointly together, which we didn't.
Right.
Would we attend certain events together? And he wasn't a very visible partner in that sense. He would come to some big occasions, but not that many. But thankfully, we don't really have kind of an office of First Lady or anything like that. So it's not that there was a high expectation that he'd be with me at everything.
Yeah.
And he also had his own career as well.
Right. Matthew and CJ, my husband, we probably get along very well. CJ has no interest in being the First Lady. I always kind of wanted to be the First Lady. So anyway, there it is. But you also came out.
Well, I do remember meeting Joe Biden. And, and I'm sure he was joking after us, but he got to find out about all the backups she had. And he's saying, like, I don't have a chief of staff.
Where are my people, right?
If you want an office of the chief of staff, you're going to have to go around schools and take on good causes.
And he's like, no thanks. Yeah, right, exactly. That's funny. Anyway, you came out and were the first openly gay Taoiseach at a time when Ireland itself was undergoing all sorts of changes. But one major campaign that you were leading in the midst of was the referendum on marriage equality 10 years ago. And I remember following that too. And you know, I came to know of you right around the time that campaign was really rolling. And I remember thinking sort of cynically, frankly, because I'm an Irish American person, a recovering Catholic, an activist academic. And I remember thinking there is no way that a public vote or referendum in Ireland, this Catholic place, which has lots of conservative instincts in terms of its social issues, right? I remember going there and realizing when I first went to Ireland in the night, like, the abortion was absolutely illegal and a crime, and I was thinking, my God. And so that lingered with me when I was following this. And yet that campaign was so spectacular, incredibly successful, 2-1 margin it won by in the referendum. A lot of people coming home from the diaspora to vote, right? And it was so moving because it was such a hearts and minds campaign. Mm. It was such a storytelling campaign and relational campaign. And so could you talk a little bit about that? Like, as someone who is gay, partnered, not married, in the middle of this historic campaign, which transformed the lives of LGBTQ people in Ireland.
Yeah, look, it was the best political campaign I was ever involved in. And by no means was I the leader, but I was one of the people who was centrally involved in it, you know, in getting Parliament to agree to put the question to the people and then fighting for the yes vote as well. Mm. It was also one that felt deeply personal.
Yeah.
And it was strange. I remember, you know, going door to door in my in my district and, you know, meeting a woman, relatively young woman with kids, somebody who looked to me like she might be a liberal voter and would be voting yes. And she said no. And she said nothing against gay people, but marriage was between men and women. It was about having children. And I actually felt a little bit hurt by it.
Of course.
Not offended, but kind of hurt. And I'd been calling to doors for, I don't know, 15, 20 years at that stage. And if people said they weren't voting for me, I wasn't that bothered. This actually felt a lot more personal. It was a great campaign. And the power behind it was storytelling.
Yeah,
it was
absolutely so moving.
Very much grassroots people who'd never been involved in the campaign before got involved. Got their parents on board, got their communities on board, got their workplaces on board. So it was a civil society campaign more than it was a political party campaign.
Yeah,
and I think that helped to tip the balance in favor. And we know this even from going back to the time of Harvey Milk that if somebody knows a gay person, they're so much more likely to be in favor of our rights and our equality.
Right.
And the more and more people who publicly became involved in the campaign and told people that they were gay and that they were looking, because it was supposed to be a vote on marriage equality, but it actually became a vote on whether gay people are acceptable in our society or not.
Yeah, it's a big
So even for those of us who weren't planning on getting married, it actually became really, really important. And then the result was really important too, because other than the very strong margin, I think it was 62-38, we carried almost all the rural counties as well.
Yes. No,
so what we'd expected was...
Across generations.
Yeah, we did, yeah. And what was expected, now, young people voted yes by bigger numbers than older people still voted yes. And our expectation had been the typical pattern that you see in politics in Ireland and the US, which would be the cities being heavily liberal and them having to vote big enough to outweigh the rural areas. And that didn't happen at all.
Yeah.
And also huge numbers of young people getting interested. Yeah. So I remember going down to vote in my local polling station, and I think there were four or five guys in their school uniforms who must have just turned 18.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen four people 18 in school uniforms going to vote before, ever in my life. You'd usually go in and you'd see the nuns from the convent out to vote early. Yeah,
and the nuns probably supported it too, some of them did.
Well, we'd a few supporters from the Catholic Church, which was... definitely helpful. Mm-hmm. One or two prominent nuns in particular who did, and one or two priests, and that definitely gave a lot of Catholics permission
to do that.
And the leader of the church in Ireland at the time, or at least the Archbishop of Dublin at the time, Dermot Martin, even though he was against it, was very generous in his response to the result. Much more in the vibe of Pope Francis than Pope Benedict, who was the Pope at the time.
Right. Where do you think Ireland's referendum and the success of it and the cultural change that it represented and the strong victory that it was sits within the larger kind of global LGBTQ movement?
I thought it was important in terms of signaling because everyone knows that Ireland is a relatively conservative country and still is in many ways, and a country where the Catholic Church and the influence of the Catholic Church was very strong. And the fact that we voted for marriage equality and did so very publicly really helped to fire up the campaigns in other places. Yeah. So, Australia was one of the big ones that came next, and Germany, were a little bit surprised that little Catholic Ireland had done this, and I think made them think about whether they should too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it influenced the US Supreme Court, but a few weeks later, the decision was made here.
And it's interesting because I have a kind of double celebration this year. This is the 10th anniversary of the Obergefell decision, which was, of course, our Supreme Court ruling, landmark ruling, making marriage equality the law of the land here. And the Irish referendum was just before that. I mean, they were almost simultaneous and probably didn't influence our Supreme Court, but I remember it influenced us. Mm. Right? I mean, watching what was happening in Ireland was so profoundly moving to someone like me. And I had just been to Ireland the year before the campaign started. And I remember thinking, this is a country that is changing and has changed and in ways that really was quite moving. And I do think that did surprise the world. And I think the Catholic thing was the reason for that. And it's interesting because I think back to the days of the marriage equality campaigns here in the United States, and Massachusetts was really, one of the major kind of early origins and early locations for that work. And in Massachusetts, and Boston, of course, is heavily Catholic, lots of Irish folks here. And the Catholic Church in the United States, not just in Boston and Massachusetts, but all across the country, was one of the major religious forces in opposition to not just marriage equality, but LGBTQ rights more broadly. And when the priest abuse scandal was broken, right, by the Boston Globe, and the journalists here, Massachusetts figures very largely in this larger story. The Catholic Church has never recovered, right? It took a hit in a way that really you could feel, and you could feel the opposition. Those of us who were on the LGBTQ side of things, you could feel that piece of the opposition weakening.
Yeah.
Not just because the culture was changing, but because the institution
and that parallel
engaged in a reckoning. And that must have happened in Ireland as well.
It did. And that parallel was very much there in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Not only were there the child abuse and institutional abuse scandals, there were also financial scandals.
That's right. Yeah.
And then, one of the bishops was found to have been having a woman and a family on the side. Mm-hmm. So all these things, an American woman, actually. Yeah. So all these things.
We have a deep and intimate relationship, transatlantic relationship.
Definitely damaged the credibility of the church in those arguments. But there are other factors as well. Mm-hmm. Country become more prosperous. Mm-hmm. People who had migrated abroad were coming home.
Yes.
And they were coming back from England and America and Australia and other places with more and Europe with more liberal ideas.
Yeah.
But even now, it does have a certain relevance. So I think about 2 years ago when Greece decided to legalize same-sex marriage, the Prime Minister of Greece, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, who again comes from a center-right party, would have had a lot of opposition from the Greek Orthodox Church, decided he was going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And he sought advice from us in Ireland as to what the wisest way was to go about it. And, among the advice that we would have given to him at the time was to focus on marriage. So we separated out the issues.
Yep.
Adoption was dealt with separately, for example.
Right.
Surrogacy was dealt with separately.
Yep.
And made it very clear to people that the question here was whether or not we were going to have equal marriage.
Right.
And it wasn't,
so it's a single issue campaign.
Yeah, you didn't have to necessarily buy the whole menu.
Yeah, right. And interesting, because you do come, as you said, from a center-right party that has a fiscal conservatism to it, but yet more open on social issues. And when you were a Taoiseach, you were presiding over, marriage equality wins the referendum, the liberalization of Ireland's abortion laws, which was, perhaps even more radical than the marriage equality stuff. You did some things that could clearly be defined as progressive. And I'm not sure that that's how you define your politics.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, as someone who came from a center-right party, who one could say presided over, quite a liberal turn in Ireland in many ways, especially on key social issues. Did that surprise you? How did you deal with that politically in terms of people on the left and the right coming for you? And did it change you?
Well, it isn't what I set out to do when I got involved in politics, but it did change me. And I'm proud that I was part of making those changes happen.
Yeah.
And I mean to defend them.
Yep.
And also help other people around the world do what we've done. I never go to another country and tell them what they should do. I just tell them about our experience and things that they might consider. Mm. But in some ways, though, I don't necessarily see it as a conflict between left and right necessarily. It doesn't have to be, because a lot of people who would consider themselves to the right of the political spectrum, they believe in freedom. Free enterprise, free markets, free trade.
Back to the free speech issue.
You can also have personal freedom.
Yeah.
And in the UK, not too far away from us, even though it has changed now, and that party has become much more conservative socially, marriage equality was brought in by David Cameron, a British conservative prime minister, took this view that it wasn't the state's role to regulate what people do in their bedroom
more
or in their relationships.
Yeah, libertarian move.
But one thing we did as well, and it is 10 years from it now, was a Gender Recognition Act.
That's right.
And it's a self-ID system. Mm-hmm. In 10 years, we've only had 1,500 people who have sought a gender recognition certificate. Mm-hmm. So the idea that floodgates were going to be opened and everyone would be lining up to change their gender, that's not the case, because it's not that easy. And I doubt very few people do it on a whim or see it as a choice. Really, it's the way they're born.
Yeah.
And then also, while we have had instances of abuse on one or two issues, a lot of the things that people feared or the scare tactics, really haven't.
Yeah.
Really haven't emerged.
Yeah. Well, that's what moral panics are, right?
Yeah.
They create an other that becomes a threat and then exaggerate the potential harm that threat will do.
And I think trans people are now very much a victim of that.
No question.
You remember the old moral panic that the homosexual teacher or the homosexual person in the locker room.
Harvey Milk and Anita Bryant. Yeah. We just taught that. Yeah, yeah, I taught that in my class.
And now the trans people are the people who are going to be in your bathroom and corrupting your children and threatening
beating
women.
You in swim meets. And
And of these 1,500 people who have successfully had their gender recognized in Ireland, I could probably count on one hand or maybe even one or two fingers the numbers who you could actually genuinely say were a threat to the safety of other people. And that would be the same for
any group.
For cis people, for straight people.
I used to joke a lot when we were having these debates in the United States, and my husband and I were at the time dating and getting serious, and we got engaged to sort of in that moment. And we were actually illegal federally for 4 years when we were legal as married couple in Massachusetts from 2011, 2015. And I remember I would go on these shows and I would, speak at these events and on marriage equality and these people, these moral panic people who were in opposition would always say, they're going to ruin the institution of marriage. And, our quip back was always like, well, 54% of straight people who are married get divorced. Yeah. Like we got to be better at it than you are. And then the other thing that I would always say is that I can guarantee you now, having been married for a number of years, are the only threat to anything that I'm not a threat to civilization. I'm a threat to motivation. I've become very boring and kind of like a house husband. So
assimilation.
Which I'm not a big fan of. I'm not an assimilationist, but it is.
I don't know about states, but in Ireland, divorce rates are relatively low.
Yeah.
But for same-sex couples, they're extremely low. So, the fear of the moral panic is that all these gay people, not so much lesbians, but all these gay men would be getting married to somebody new every 3 or 4 years, and that's like not materialized at all.
No, it's really true. And the other thing that hasn't happened, quite the opposite, in fact, is the harm to children, which is of course one of the main refrains of the homophobic and transphobic right.
And that's not gone away.
It hasn't gone away. It's still there, still very much there. And I mean, even the priest abuse scandal, right? When they found out the priests were abusing little boys, they were like, oh, it's all these gay priests. It was like they tried to pin that on us. I'm like, no, this is a church thing, not a gay thing. But there's all sorts of research now, because we're now 10 years in, and in Massachusetts we're 20 years in terms of marriage equality. So you have LGBTQ families with children who have adopted or had children naturally, etc., who we have longitudinal data to suggest that the children of same-sex married couples are actually doing better by a whole series of metrics in terms of academic performance, in terms of college access, in terms of mental health experiences and so forth. So there's actually the data suggests an opposite narrative, right? That actually like gay and lesbian and queer married couples and families are really good parents, it turns out, and loving families. So it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise you. But,
at least certainly no evidence to the contrary.
Right, exactly.
What would matter.
Right. So it flies in the face of the opposition that's fueled by that moral panic. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, you and I have had several conversations now that we've become friends about social change. And I run a global LGBTQI human rights program here at the Carl Ryan Center. And I'm a lefty, I'm a progressive, I'm one of the woke professors, so quote unquote. And so when I think about incrementalism as the sort of main approach to social change, that's not generally where I land. It's certainly not where I start, even though I think it's understandable within legal and political and policy institutions that it's going to take a little bit longer and the pace is a little bit more glacial. Same thing in higher education, I would argue. But I tend to be more of a sort of let's take the big leaps forward and let's go big or go home. And you're more of an incrementalist, I would think. You've identified yourself in that way. So talk to me a bit about like how you think about social change, both in your role as a former head of state, like a party leader and a political leader, but also as like now a global citizen who's involved in all sorts of change work, right? We're here recording this podcast at a summit that we have for international queer activists who are here from all over the world doing this amazing work. And you've been working with them this whole week and with us. And so has your ideas about how to get to, how to get to progress and freedom and equality and rights changed?
Yeah, well, I always say that politics essentially is about building a coalition for change or a coalition for action, and putting you and your group at the head of that, and making sure that you build a majority, and ideally a solid majority, which cannot then be reversed a few years later. And that may mean having to go at a pace that's slower than you might like or your coalition might like. So I am an incrementalist, but I'm not an incrementalist always and absolutely. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I found myself doing when we were liberalizing our abortion laws, when I became prime minister, abortion was only allowed in very limited circumstances, mm-hmm. which would be a threat to the life of the mother essentially. Yes. And I'd initially planned an incremental approach, which would allow it in very limited circumstances, mm-hmm. like a fatal fetal abnormality, you know, rape, incest, a woman that's under, a girl who's pregnant, you know, the kind of hard cases that you'll often hear talked about. Yeah. And as we consulted with different groups, with the public, as I tried to write down that law as to how somebody would establish that they were pregnant as a result from rape or incest, I actually decided, no, we're not doing this. Mm. We are going to go big. And thankfully, won that one, but it was a risk because I knew it was a higher risk to ask the people to endorse abortion on request up to 12 weeks and then in certain circumstances thereafter, which is what we settled on. Mm-hmm. But that's an example, I suppose, where I decided incrementalism was not the right approach.
So what made you say
it's
that,
not absolute.
That it was not the right approach in that moment? Because that is a big gamble.
Yeah,
and it was a risk. And it did. And I'm also wondering, like, did your training as a doctor feed into that at all?
A little bit because, I had patients who had crisis pregnancies. Right. And at the time, you couldn't refer them or help them obtain an abortion, but you could give them information if they wanted it, which I did. And even now, doctors are asked to give non-directive information. It's the options, and the woman then decides for themselves. Mm. There were a couple of things. We were starting to see the arrival of the abortion pills in the post.
Yeah.
That was illegal in Ireland. Unless you're going to check the mail, it's going to get through. Banning it actually makes it more dangerous from our experience. Yeah. And people were using those pills in their homes and then getting sick. And that was one thing that occurred to me, is that would continue and probably get worse if we made it too restrictive. And then talking to my female friends and colleagues, you know, female members of parliament, trying to write the law where somebody would go before a committee and have to establish that they were a victim of rape or incest or something else, or actually just requiring women to lie. Right. And I just...
On top of everything
I
else.
I kind of balked at that in the end. And what we settled on was 12 weeks first trimester on request and then only in certain circumstances thereafter.
I mentioned you being a doctor, and you also were a teacher during the pandemic, and you continue to practice and do that. And
I went back into practice to do the vaccine program.
And so, like, how do you? I mean, that's a unique or certainly uncommon combination of qualities and work. And so, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, like, how the doctor in you influenced the politician in you.
Like, to a certain extent, it was. I went back into practice mainly as a gesture of solidarity with the health workers who were out being exposed to the virus all the time, including many of my family. But also we were trying to get the vaccines out as quickly as possible. And, why not give a few hours of my time down the vaccine center, which I did. But I know a colleague of mine, Mark Rutte, who's now head of NATO and was the prime minister of the Netherlands. He used to still teach a class in university once a week. And he felt that grounded him. And obviously gave students an opportunity too. So it was something that I was kind of keen to do. But I definitely think one of the advantages in having studied medicine when you then go into politics is understanding the scientific method and looking for evidence-based solutions. Another thing as well is the communications, because a large part of being a doctor is, one, demonstrating to people that you're on their side.
Right.
If your patient doesn't believe that you have their best interests at heart, it doesn't matter what you tell them to do.
That's
really important in politics. And that's an issue you can see around the world is a lot of the public now think the wrong people are on their side. So convincing people that you're on their side is really important. And then the other thing is being able to explain complicated concepts in simple language people can understand, but not in a way they feel talked down to. So when I was at my best, I was achieving those things, but I wasn't always at my best, unfortunately.
So what you're saying is that when it comes to leadership and communication, being smart and clear and trustworthy is a good set of things.
And above all, on your side.
Because
people doesn't matter what you say.
If
people don't think you're on their side and that you have their interests at heart, you're already on the back foot.
Yeah. So speaking of on your side, there's a brilliant little nugget of history that you and I talked about a year ago when you were here at Harvard about the relationship between Ireland and one of our indigenous tribal nations here in the United States.
Yeah.
And so, and that has that has a 19th century origin and that has evolved and continues to this present day. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that, because one, and I won't spoil it, I'll let you explain the history, but one of the things about that and so much of Ireland's history is that I find Ireland as a European country, its history is much more, it's a post-colonial, right, and revolutionary kind of politics as opposed to a colonial or imperial politics, which puts Ireland on the side of a lot of indigenous groups who struggle for freedom. Yeah. Right? The Irish have been very supportive of Gazans and Palestinians in the current war and conflict in Israel and Palestine. And so and I wonder if like that history, right, and the kind of uniqueness of Ireland's history makes it more politically on the side of the underdogs.
Yeah, I think that's true. As is always the case, history is more complicated than we care to admit. And for a long time, Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, not just part of the British Empire, but elected MPs to the House of Commons. Mm-hmm. And when you go to India and you see the gravestones of many of the soldiers there, you see Irish names.
Yeah.
And of course, when you come to America, we often talk about how the Irish helped to build America.
Yeah.
We don't talk about the fact that America was not empty when they arrived. So, you know, we actually, our story is more complicated than we care to admit. But what has very much become our national narrative is a, you know, history of having been invaded, having been occupied, having been settled,
oppressed,
having been expelled to certain parts of our country. When Cromwell came to Ireland, he said to hell or to Connacht that Irish people had to move west so the English could take the land. And then, of course, the thing that is very large in our history and in our collective memory is the Great Famine.
Of course.
When the population is still not recovered from it, by the way, when 1 million died in the famine and 1 million were forced to emigrate. And there was a surplus of food in the country at the time.
Yes.
So had the government in London wanted to end the famine, they could have, they didn't. Yeah.
That's the detail that always crushes me.
And so when we see what are essentially man-made famines, whether it's in Gaza or Ethiopia or Sudan, we feel a real affinity with the people who are victims of that, who are never to blame for what groups might do in their name or what their leaders or the mistakes their leaders might make. But the story that you touched on is the story of the Choctaws.
Choctaws, yeah.
One of the First Nations. And around the time of the Irish famine, they were being expelled from their lands in southern states and were being sent to Oklahoma. And they were part of the Trail of Tears. And during that period, they raised money and donated it to famine relief in Ireland. And that connection has maintained ever since. So when I was Prime Minister, I visited the Choctaw in Oklahoma. And even when I was here in Harvard last time, there was a Choctaw student.
I know.
Came
I remember
to the forum
that.
Who
asked the question.
Who knew this story. So so it also shows the power of solidarity.
That's right.
Is it 170 years later now?
Oh, almost 200 years later. Yeah. 180 years,
180.
One of the things
One thing that crops up in Ireland as well is the whole issue around reparations.
Right.
And every now and then there's a suggestion that, you know, that Britain and England should give us reparations for the famine.
Yeah.
And I always say, no, let's help the people who are actually experiencing famine. And that's I think, genuine solidarity. It's let's help the people who are now suffering what we suffered rather than necessarily seeking restitution. Not that I'm opposed to that in all circumstances, particularly if people are still feeling the effects of injustice.
Right, as you said, I mean, for me, it's a both and. As long as there's an abundance of things to prepare. I want just a quick pop cultural question. Have you seen the movie Sinners? Ryan Coogler's new movie Sinners.
With
Michael B. Jordan. Oh, we have to go see that together because it's a remarkable work of art. It's actually one of the most fabulous movies I've seen in a long time, but there's a whole interweaving of African or Southern African American, Irish and Irish American, and Choctaw cultural conflagrations, and it's a vampire movie, and so it's wild as a movie. But there are several scenes where you see the Choctaw and the Irish and African American people and music and cultural history come together in these absolutely spectacular scenes. So, any movie that says Sinners is one that calls to me for all sorts of other reasons, but you would love it because it actually,
When did it come out?
It'll be hopefully up for sort of Oscar consideration this year, but it's Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, stars in it. And it's a really remarkable thing, but actually that history is in this movie. And it's, I wasn't ready for it. And I think I actually was so moved by it because of the conversation that we had when you were last here about that Choctaw Ireland connection. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about, you talked about reparations. Let's talk about another R word, reunification. Mm. And you've been outspoken about Irish reunification, and I know have lots of really compelling and interesting thoughts about it. It's something that feels to me to be, if not taboo, certainly a tricky subject to bring up and to bring on. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you stand on that and how you think about this as a possibility moving forward.
Yeah, so I think the context really starts with the Good Friday Agreement in 1997, which ended the violence in Northern Ireland, and that allows for Northern Ireland to stay in the United Kingdom, but with a system of autonomy and power sharing that respects the rights of both communities in the North. And people in Northern Ireland are allowed to be British and Irish, or both, or British or Irish and both. So that's an important identity principle upheld. Yeah. But it also provides for unification. And there would not have been a Good Friday Agreement without provision for unification. And that says that if
as a forward-looking,
Again, it doesn't say it's inevitable,
right?
But it is considered in our constitution to be an aspiration. Mm-hmm. And when there's a majority north and south, it's supposed to come about, or at least the vote is supposed to happen. Mm. And if you look at the numbers, younger people, in particular in the north, heavily favour unification, particularly since the UK left the European Union. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not inevitable. No progress is. I think it's something we should press for and something we should think about. Because again, it'll come down to a vote, a vote of the people. And we really need to fully understand what the question is and also all the really practical questions people are going to ask. Mm. You know, what's going to happen with healthcare charges? What will happen with teachers' pay? What will happen with student fees? You know, all those things that are different north and south. People are going to want to ask some very practical questions, there aren't solid answers to them yet.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't agree with some people who say, let's set a date. I say, actually, don't set a date yet. We're not ready yet. But let's start getting the work done. And then there are others who say, let's not rock the boat. We don't do violence. Don't poke the bear.
Of course,
But I would disagree with them too.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I'm also inspired by the fact that you seem willing to lead that conversation, even if, you know, you're going to take some, speaking of violence, take some, you know, metaphorically at least, take some hits.
I can live with that.
Yeah.
And it's always the same hit.
It's not your first rodeo.
Yeah, it's not. And it's always the same criticism. You know, it's not the right time. They will never tell you when the right time is.
Right, exactly. They don't have their date either.
Or that you're trying to do it, you know, to get attention or distract from some other issue.
Right.
But you know, when people are making those arguments, you're probably on a winner.
Yeah, that's right. Good point. So your book is called Speaking My Mind, and you are someone that I've gotten to know over the last year or so, and I find you fascinating in many, many ways.
Thank you.
I've become a friend, and so I appreciate this time together. And I'm just wondering, like, when you say speaking your mind, I'm a big believer in, like, speaking truth to power. I teach leadership and communications. I study social movements. And so I'm drawn to people who like to speak their mind in various ways. And I have my own ways of speaking my mind. But what can you say and do now, or what do you want to say and do now that you couldn't do when you were a teacher?
Well, it's I have personal and intellectual freedom now, which I didn't have. Like you say, it's great to be able to speak truth to power when you are power. it's actually quite hard to speak the truth to people sometimes because often they won't want to hear it. Certainly when I started off in politics, I was able to very much speak my mind, say what I wanted to say. even if it was provocative or unpopular or challenged people. As you move up the ladder, that does become harder, you know, in part because you have responsibilities and accountabilities and you're responsible to your constituency, the district that elected you. You're a member of a party, and a party will have certain positions that you're supposed to sign up to and agree to. Then you're in a government where there's a doctrine of collective responsibility, or you may be in a coalition, and you have to be aware that something you might say might be contrary to the agreement that you made, or might cause trouble within your party or trouble within your coalition. So, you know, I did find myself being less myself and having to bite my tongue or having to speak in the way politicians do, with caveats and and subclauses. And I don't really have to do that anymore. I can be a bit more sharp-tongued.
Well, when you were...
But also because there's no real consequences, because what I now say is much less important than, than a year ago or 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's funny. And when you were a T-shirt... People might have said free Leo, and now we have free Leo, which is great. Excellent. So I wanted to end with an Irish quote from a poet, and I often use this quote from Yeats, which is, being Irish, he had an abiding sense of tragedy, which sustained him through temporary periods of joy. And I sort of love that characterization. And there's a certain truth embedded in it. And we are living in a world, when it comes to human rights and social justice, a world full of tragedies right now, right? They're bearing down hard on us and our countries and our communities. And some of those tragedies, all of those tragedies are man-made, that's our person-made. And there's been a turn, as you said, back in the day, but at the beginning of this interview, you know, we grew up in a time when the wall in Berlin was coming down and apartheid was being dismantled and the Soviet Union was breaking up and Russia seemed to be moving in a democratic direction. And there was a lot of free speech movements and youth energy. That was a world historical, you know, if not revolutionary, then certainly transformational time. We are living in, it's like the upside down times now, the opposite of that in so many ways. And so obviously the tragedies are real and they're profound and they're abundant, but there's joy too. And one thing about queer people and gay people and LGBTQ people is that we have a sense of humor. We have a sense of flair, right? We're fierce and fabulous and other kinds of things, not to trade in stereotypes, but I'll do it for a second. What kind of joy do you find, and what kind of like queer joy do you find, or are you willing to sort of lean into now that brings you puts a smile on your face?
That's a good question. Yeah, you didn't give me the questions in advance.
I didn't give you the questions in advance.
I haven't thought of that one at all. I don't know.
So you're not yet fully free.
Yeah, I think I am.
You are, yeah. Well,
what I definitely do like is being able to go to other countries and give them solidarity and advice on what they can achieve. And I was in Budapest in Hungary the week that Pride was banned. I visited Bulgaria too.
That's right.
And actually, one thing I'm kind of hoping to do now is to get to some prides that really are the traditional prides, and in some parts of Eastern Europe, you know, hooligans and far right people turn out to threaten people, and I want to be there alongside our comrades in those countries.
Wow,
not sure that's joy though, is it?
It's a form of joy. Well, it's joy in the midst of tragedy, right?
We'll confront their hate with our joy.
Yes, exactly. Confront their hate with our joy. Exactly. Maybe I'll go on tour with you. We can do a pride tour together to the authoritarian prides. Exactly. Well, one thing,
of course, in those countries, the police aren't there to protect you. So it's pretty dangerous.
That's right. That's exactly.
But having somebody who, you know, was a former prime minister, in some ways, you're a little bit of a human shield.
Right. Yeah, I love that. Well, as you know, we have a standing invitation to Provincetown. That will bring you some joy on behalf of our community and in our community. And on behalf of us here at the Carr Ryan Center, where you're a senior fellow with our global LGBTQI+ human rights program, thanks for your time. Thanks for this conversation. And it's really wonderful to be connected to you in this way. And we look forward to lots of good work in the future.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure and look forward to working together.
Thanks. Leo Varadkar, thank you for joining us today on Justice Matters. And thanks to our podcast team, Kyle Faniff, Meg Foley-Yoder, and Peter Kakoma. Justice Matters is a podcast production of the Carr Ryan Center for Human Rights at the Harvard Kennedy School. The podcast co-hosts are Matthias Risse, Aminta Awesome, Diego Garcia Blum, and Maggie Gates. And me today, Timothy Patrick McCarthy. You can find more information about the podcast on our website at www.hks.harvard.edu/centers/Carr Ryan. Thank you for listening to Justice Matters. We'll talk to you next time.